Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of Crazy Money. This is your host, Paul. Today is a great day to be alive, and it is a wonderful day to listen to a conversation I just had with a new friend. His name is Rabbi Steve Leader. He's the senior rabbi at Wilshire Boulevard Temple, a very large and influential congregation in Los Angeles, California. He is a New York Times bestselling author of several books, including For You When I Am Gone and The Beauty of What Remains. Both of these books are about dying. The Beauty of What Remains is specifically about the death of his father after a long battle with Alzheimer's. And I really was interested and looking forward to speaking with Rabbi Leader about the contrast between the way his dad died and the way my dad died, a much less chaotic death, less painful death, you might say, that had the same net result, but in an interesting way, I think the way that our respective fathers died made it easier. Well, the way my dad died made it much easier for me to grieve or not to grieve, to celebrate and be grateful, as opposed to having to unload a lot of other stuff, that pain that was caused by the way in which he died. Anyway, that's what I was going to talk to him about. But as with many great conversations, what I planned on didn't end up being the conversation at all. And in fact, in the hour plus that we spoke, it went by so fast, I didn't get to half of what I wanted to talk to him about. We did talk about all kinds of great stuff like regret and forgiveness and the life of a rabbi. He shares some very interesting insights about fundraising, his thoughts about what scripture is and whether it's based on fact or about human truths. And his explanation really made me feel better about scripture. And I look forward to hearing what you think about his interpretation. We also talked about the conflict of conscience he experienced when counseling one of his temple members who had Lou Gehrig's disease, and what he said to her when she asked for his permission to take her own life. Finally, I couldn't talk to Rabbi Leader without asking him specifically about Israel and to share some insights into the war between Hamas and Israel right now, something that is extremely personal to him. And I learned a good bit by listening to his point of view. I hope you will find it every bit as interesting as I did. I am pleased to share this conversation with Rabbi Steve Leader. Do you know my buddy Rob Goldberg from Minneapolis?
I do, of course. We're in the same group chat, Minnesota Vikings group chat.
Prominent Jews in LA, and what brings them together, the Vikings?
We went to the same high school. We grew up in the same little suburb of...
You went to Blake as well?
I'm sorry. I think it was his brother who went to Park High. But we grew up in St. Louis Park, both of us.
Okay. So we're going to talk about death today. You ready for an hour of death?
Always.
All death, all the time with Rabbi Steve Leader.
Not to be too cute about it, but that means we're going to spend an hour actually talking about life.
That's absolutely right. Well, before we jump into your story, and I got a lot of questions about the role a rabbi plays around death, because I didn't really think, you know, I grew up Catholic. I was an altar boy. I served at funeral masses. I went to a lot of funerals with priests, but I didn't think so much about rabbis doing the same thing. But obviously, that's what you do. You serve your congregation in times of joy and in sadness, right?
That's right.
But before we jump into all that, I have to ask you this. O.J. Yeah. Simpson died yesterday. If you were called to O.J.'s bedside, what would that conversation have gone like?
I would have asked him if he was afraid. And depending upon his answer, I would have assured him that what is ahead for him is perfect and complete peace and rest. And something that was probably so elusive for him most of his life. And I would mostly listen. When people are dying, their fears are almost never for themselves. They're for the other people around them that they care about. And they need to be reassured that those people are going to be okay. I mean, he would die like anyone else. This business of deathbed confessions and all of that, that's just not how it goes.
No.
People die, in most cases, exactly the way they live. So if a person lives in denial or lives professing innocence, they die in denial and they die professing innocence. Death doesn't give anyone, the living or the dying, a new personality. It doesn't, you know.
Some might argue my personality would be improved through...
Well, yeah. But people have this fantasy that now that someone's dying, there's going to be a radical change in that person or in that family or in the relationship. And they're almost always profoundly disappointed. You know, there's this old joke about the Jews that the Jews are like everyone else, just more so. And right. You can say it about the French. You could say it about, you know, there are a lot of ways to tell joke. Yeah. But originally it was a joke by Heinrich Heine, a German Jewish poet, who said that about the Jews, that we're like everyone else, just more so. This has been my experience, which is vast, actually, with death and dying. It doesn't give anyone a new personality. It makes everyone more so.
That's what people say about money, too, that when you come into extreme wealth, that you just become more of who you are. Everything is amplified.
I think that's right. Extremes tend to reveal the distillate, the essence of a human being, good and bad. You know, since we're talking about money, Warren Buffett's the one who said, right, when the tide goes out, you see who's been swimming naked, right?
That's right, yep.
It's the same thing. You're more so. You were kind of doing kabuki and broke. And then when things get worse, it's more so. So these life events, positive and negative, intensify us. They rarely profoundly alter us. And in most cases, that's really good news.
I'm not trying to pick on OJ. I wanted to draw listeners in with the salacious, however. So now that they're captured by your wisdom and my humor and our respective good looks, I should say.
We have the same barber too.
And that's correct. Have you been in a situation where somebody expressed profound regret or fear of retribution on their deathbed?
No. And I have been
never in thousands of encounters.
Never. Never. Now, let me clarify that. I'm not telling you that they have no regrets, but I have never heard some kind of dramatic deathbed confessional or turnaround. Like, I'm so sorry I didn't this or didn't that. Because when a person is actively dying, in my experience, which is anecdotal but pretty vast, I have never had someone express fear for themselves. I have had people, in fact, usually people do die with some fear, but it's not about themselves. It's fear for the people they're leaving behind. Will they be okay? Will the kids be okay? Will he be okay without me? Will she be okay without me? Their fears are always about others, not themselves. Now, you bring up an interesting question about regret. So one of the books I wrote, which is called For You When I Am Gone, it's 12 chapters. Each is a question to help you define your life. The very first question is, what do you regret? And here's what I do know about elderly approaching end of life regret. What most people regret most when they look back on their lives is not something they did. It's something they didn't do.
For example,
I should have gone on that trip with my girlfriend in college to Istanbul instead of staying home and studying for my econ exam or whatever it is. But it's more profound than that. I should have made peace. I should have honored my child's blueprint more than I did. So there are two kinds. To put it in religious terms, I'll call them sins. To put it in secular terms, I'll call them mistakes. There are two types. There are sins of commission, the things we do. And then there are sins of omission, the things we didn't do. The time we didn't show up to defend someone we cared about. The times we didn't speak out. I mean, who doesn't, since you're, you know, essentially you see things through the lens of money, who doesn't have a missed opportunity business story?
Sure.
The piece of real estate they wish they had bought, the stock they wish they had bought, right? Or the stock they wish they had dumped. Everyone has these regrets related to what we did not do. And generally, those regrets are rooted in the soil of overthinking, over on the one hand, on the other handing, and subordinating our hearts to our intellect.
Say that again. Subordinating our hearts to our intellect.
Yes. So let's ask you a question, one that's in that book.
Mm-hmm.
When was a time? Well, let's start with this. I know I'm turning the tables on the podcaster.
Please. But we're having a conversation. Guys talking.
So what do you in your life regret the most?
You know, a couple of terrible things that I did, but then a bunch of minor stuff, like silly things I said to people.
No, I'm talking about the most.
The most.
Your greatest regret in life.
An act of commission.
What'd you do?
I'm not going to say.
Okay.
I hurt somebody I cared about.
Okay. Was that act or decision made with your heart or your head?
My body.
Okay, I understand. I would say then that what I'm trying to get at in terms of regret is when we privilege other things above our hearts, That's when we tend to limit the sins and regrets of omission. Most sins and regrets of omission are because we talk ourselves out of something that our heart wants to do.
Right.
A profession, showing up at something, a love affair with someone, whatever it is.
Standing up for a weak person that would cost you social status or something like that.
Correct. And I'm not telling you that we don't need a heart-mind balance and that we shouldn't be subordinating a whim. We should. But when you really feel it and you ignore that destiny, it turns into a massive regret for most people.
When people are expressing regret on their deathbed, what do you say to them?
First of all, mostly they don't. I'm talking not about deathbed. This is, you know, at an 80th birthday party, an 85th birthday party. But when people are actively dying, they're not expressing regret.
But
they're
all not. Walk around with regret in our head constantly. Right. We beat ourselves up every day about things big and small.
Right.
And it's the most unproductive emotion feeling you can have, probably.
Yes and no. I mean, addicts have to hit bottom in order to start recovery. So it's not always a terrible thing. Sometimes the disruption of pain is the only thing that gets us to improve. Pain is the only teacher, period. Success doesn't teach you very much.
As Dennis Miller said, nobody goes to Jesus on prom night.
Yeah. Yeah. Pain is the great teacher, and death is the great validator of life. So I wouldn't say that it's always a bad thing. First of all, regret also demonstrates that you actually have a conscience, which is a positive thing. Good for you. I am glad that you feel badly about this, Paul, because it proves that you have a conscience and a soul and that you're a fundamentally good person. And every human being is in one of three states of being, either has done, is doing, or will do something incredibly stupid. Okay? That is definitionally what it means to be human.
Sure. Yeah.
That's what I would say to you. And the other thing, and this is very kind of inside baseball for rabbis and for clergy in general, I think, or at least for me and the way I approach these things, because we're not therapists. I don't see people for months or years in any kind of therapeutic way. If you came to me and said, Steve, I did this terrible thing. It was stupid. I don't know why I did it, but you know, it's ruining my family, my marriage. I don't know what to do. The first thing I would say to you, because I want to triage this and get you headed quickly in a better direction. The first thing I'm going to say to you is, you know something, Paul? I don't know about you, but personally, I've given up all hope for a better past. You cannot have a better past. This now has to become about the future. And that immediately does so many important things, not the least of which is it turns you forward. It puts you face forward to the wind, chest forward to the wind. It also indicates that you are not doomed to repeat the past, that you are capable of a different future, a better future. You are not shackled to yesterday's ways. By saying I've given up all hope of a better past, you are also simultaneously saying, but I have nothing but hope for a better future for you. And that's really important. That's called faith. You know, there's this story, if I can get a little like biblical on you for a second, it's in my nature. And you were an altar boy, so you probably know this anyway, but some of your listeners may not. You know, there's this story in the Hebrew Bible about Sodom and Gomorrah, these wicked cities that Abraham tries to save, but God says, no, there aren't even 10 decent human beings in these cities. I'm going to destroy them. I'm going to rain fire down upon them. You and your family get out, and I'm going to destroy these wicked cities, and you must not look back. They leave, and Abraham's nephew, Lot, his wife, turns and looks back as Sodom and Gomorrah are being destroyed. And as the Bible puts it, she turns into a pillar of salt. Now, I have always understood this to mean that if we live our lives oriented to the destruction of our past, the misery of our past, we become bitter and paralyzed like a pillar of salt. And while it is true that those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it, Santayana was right about that. But he left out the other half, the other shoe that should have dropped, which is, while those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it, it is also true that those who only remember the past are doomed to repeat it. If you cannot imagine or seek a different path, a different way, then you are shackled to the past.
So while regret has positive benefits to encourage the person to change, rumination and obsession with our mistakes, at a certain point, becomes unproductive and then counterproductive.
Correct. And you have to get help. I'm a big advocate for mental health. There's this beautiful phrase, I won't walk you through the whole story, but there's a beautiful phrase, punchline to a story in the Talmud. And the punchline is, the prisoner cannot free himself. It's a very powerful idea. The prisoner cannot free himself. When we feel stuck, paralyzed, imprisoned, shackled, the path to freedom comes by reaching out. You have to reach out. You got to stick your hand through the bars and reach out for help. Because you're right, when you are not able to reorient yourself to the future, when you are not able to achieve any level of self-forgiveness, you need help. And help makes it all the difference. I've been in this situation myself more than once. And I could not have gotten out of it without help.
We were going to talk about death the whole time, but now we got to talk about a lot more. I want to think about your time as a rabbi and a pie chart. What's the percentage breakdown of how you spend your time?
Well, like most professions that you're devoted to, it's the 80-20. So I do 80% of what I don't like to do 20% of what I do like.
And what are those things?
I consider them all important, right? You don't get to do the last 20%. You don't get to score the touchdown until you get it into the red zone, right? So I accept it as part of what it means to develop a craft and to be ambitious. You do a lot of things that aren't thrilling all the time. So the pie chart, here's the situation. The pie chart changes, it evolves. There are four major, now five, I would say, major parts to my rabbinate. Mine is unusual. I have a very large multi-campus, multi-school, multi-service center kind of congregation. If Jews had a mega church, it would be Wilshire Boulevard Temple.
You're the Joel Osteen of Judaism.
Well, he has way better hair. No, I don't sell out stadiums, but I'm saying it's a very large synagogue. Very.
And full of influential people.
Yes. So my role encompasses five major components. I can do any two of the five really well at the same time, and the other three suffer. And that's just something I've had to make peace with. I often tell our staff, we can do anything, but we can't do everything. So we need to be strategic with our time and our resources. So what are the parts? First of all, taking care of members of the congregation. I call it hatch, match, and dispatch, right? The babies, the weddings, the funerals, the hospital visits, the counseling sessions, all of that. You got to show up and take care of people. They have every right to expect that of you. And you shouldn't be a rabbi unless that's in your heart. So that's number one. And these are not hierarchical. I'm just giving you all five. Number two, taking care of the staff. We have about 450 people who work for us full time.
Wow.
And a lot of part-time people. And they have lives and problems too. So I was just on the phone this morning trying to help someone who works for us get her son's MRI done sooner than the month they were told they have to wait.
Surely you've got a radiologist in your congregation that can help you.
Well, more importantly, we have physicians and donors at the major hospitals who can help when there's a little boy's health in jeopardy and the system is overburdened. So taking care of our employees. So it's taking care of our members, taking care of our employees and their families. And then there is the preaching and the teaching and the speaking, all of that, and the writing and the scholarship. That's another. Number four is the fundraising, because this institution is large and ambitious and therefore needs to be fed. And that relationship building and fundraising takes an extraordinary amount of time and is extraordinarily important. And then the fifth, which is fairly recent for me, let's go back, say, 10 years when my third book came out, is the more prominent sort of national religious leader figure, however you want to put it, all of that. The books and the media segments, you know, talk shows, TV shows, news media, all of that stuff, and social media, where over the past 10 years, really, and even more so the past 5 years, I've spent more time and effort because I see it as a parallel lane that I can transition to as I dial things down at the congregation as I get older. So those are five things, any two of which I can do very, very well, and the others suffer. At times in my life, I have fundraised and taken care of temple members, and I haven't written a thing. I haven't written a major sermon. I haven't written a book. I haven't taught a class. I just can't. I don't have the bandwidth. There are times when I've written books and I've dialed down the fundraising. I took 3 months off. I didn't raise any money and I wrote a book. So you cannot do it all the time, but those are the components. So it's a little hard to answer the pie chart question unless you're asking me the pie chart question at a specific given moment. Then I could give you a snapshot. But my pie chart today is different than it was 2 years ago.
So you mentioned the 80-20 rule, and I know from reading your book, Beauty of What Remains, about the death of your father, which I do want to talk about, but I know from reading that book that the thing you don't love to do is raise money. So is that part of the 80 that allows you to do the 20?
It's the 80 that allows everyone to do the 20.
Yeah.
Not just me. Frankly, it gets in the way of the 20 I want to do, but it facilitates the 20 that the institution needs to fulfill its mission.
What have you learned about people by asking them for money?
Well, I have learned a number of things. First of all, there are really nice rich people and really, really asshole rich people. There are really nice upper middle class people and really asshole middle class people, upper middle class people. There are really nice working class and poor people and really asshole working class. And it has nothing to do with money. Okay? It has to do with other factors. People will indulge rich assholes more than others, but they're still assholes. Okay? So I've learned that people are people on a fundamental level. But in terms of fundraising itself as a craft or an art, because it is much more art than science, fundamentally, it's about relationships. People don't really give big sums of money to causes. They give to people, people they trust to deliver something good for them, the world, society, art, music, whatever it is. But they're really giving to you, which comes with a lot of responsibility and, frankly, a lot of gratitude. So people give to people. They don't really give to causes, generally. Number two, I have learned that if you want to raise money, ask for advice.
Mm.
If you want advice, ask for money. Right?
That's funny.
It's true. If the first time I meet you, you know, I get my 20 minutes in your office and you're a billionaire, I say, hey, I'm rebuilding this temple here and the Jews need help and I'd like you to give $10 million. I'm going to get a lot of advice from you, Paul. You know who you should see, Rabbi? You should go see George down the street. That guy. I'm not saying I go hungry, but that guy. I mean, he really, you know, you're going to get a lot of advice.
That's great.
On the other hand, if I say, Paul, you're one of the smartest people I know about money. I listen to your podcast. I remember your son's bar mitzvah. I remember what you said to him. I remember when you talked to him about the difference between self-worth and net worth. And so I'm really coming to you for advice. I'm not coming to you to ask for money. That day may come, Paul, but it's not today. Here's my problem. If this was your problem, how would you approach it? Now, two good things are going to happen. I'm going to learn a lot because these people are smart. And number two, you and I are going to start to develop a relationship where you feel valued because you are valued for something beyond your checkbook.
Which is what everybody else values you for.
Bingo.
Right.
And for me, it's important for my own dignity that I approach it this way because I don't want to be engaged in a bunch of kabuki to get rich people to write checks. I don't want to live that way. I'll go to the opera with you and I hate the opera. Okay. But I don't want to see people merely as targets. I don't want to objectify people. And I really have learned, you know, I've stayed at this congregation my entire career, 38 years. Most rabbis have had 2, 3, 4, 5 congregations by now that I was ordained with. And the reason I have stayed is not for want of other opportunities. The reason I've stayed is because of the incredible community of people that I am immersed in. Amazing.
Hey, everybody. We'll be right back with Steve Leader in just a second. But I want to tell you about some comedy shows that I'm performing coming up someplace near you or near somebody you love. So you should call them and tell them that they should go see my comedy show that is near them. April 18th, Atlanta Athletic Club in Johns Creek, Georgia. I will be opening for Jay Larson in Los Angeles, California. The following night and the following night after that, two nights, April 19th and 20th, Friday and Saturday night, two shows each night at the DC Comedy Loft. I'll be with my buddy Paul Farivar doing our Two Pauls, One Show. Easy to get that one mixed up. May 3rd and 4th, I'll be headlining the Denver Comedy Lounge in Denver, Colorado. May 5th, I'll be at the Boulder Comedy Show in Boulder, Colorado. May 17th, at the Cary Theater in Cary, North Carolina with Paul Farivar again. Also the next night with Paul at the Idiot Box in Greensboro, North Carolina. Memorial Day weekend, May 24th through 26th at the Vail Comedy Festival in Vail, Colorado. June 19th, don't tell anybody because it's not confirmed yet, but we'll probably be at Side Splitters in Sarasota, Florida. That's me and Paul again. June 20th at Off the Hook Comedy Club in Naples, Florida. That one's confirmed. June 21st and 22nd, I'll be opening for Paul at the Vero Beach Comedy Zone. Also, September 26th, yeah, it's 5 months away, but you should put it on your calendar. Dallas, Texas, we'll be at the Dallas Comedy Club. So, y'all, check out more dates on my website, paulallinger.com. Hope to see you out there. Now back to Rabbi Leader. So the kids you've hatched, you've now matched, some of which you have dispatched. You're seeing the full cycle here.
Yes, I'm Like, I'm the exception to free agency in baseball.
Right.
You know?
Is there a transfer portal among the top Jewish congregations? There should be.
Yeah. Yeah, but I stay put. And yeah, I'm now officiating at weddings for children whose parents' weddings I officiated at. And it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a depth of meaning that is so powerful. And, you know, it really means something when people say, Steve, you knew my parents, you knew my grandparents. Now here you are at my son's bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah. It's meaningful. It's a real and human connection. And it makes up for the marketing meetings, the budget meetings, the PR meetings, the admissions meetings, the financial aid meetings, all of that, the staff meetings, the clergy meetings. I don't remember the author of that book, Death by Meeting, but it's a very good title. And there is a lot of that 80% that if I'm not there, things won't go the way I feel they should from a directional and quality standpoint. But also that I don't have to be a rabbi to be sitting in that room. So I'm feeling like, what am I, you know, come on, really? I need to be here to talk about unruly kids swinging from the banister, really?
That's probably the Goldberg kids, is my guess. I know those. Yeah. You talk about poignant experiences, real human connections. And one of the stories you tell in your book, The Beauty of What Remains, is this incredible conflict of conscience that you had.
Chapter 4.
Well, why don't you tell the story?
I'm assuming.
Tara.
Yeah. Yeah. This was the chapter that caused the stir in the Orthodox Jewish world.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Well, it would make sense, right? Because.
Yeah, I'm not in that Facebook group.
Yeah, but I'll. Plenty of room on the bus, Paul.
We're not done yet. Who knows?
Might be a little surgery involved, but so what? Come on.
No, we're good there. We're good there.
Okay. Good to know. Good to know. All right. So this is what happened. And I used the name Tara in the book for obvious reasons. So I'm going to use it here. So Tara was a woman, as we were just talking about, who I, you know, knew well for decades. And barn bat mitzvah for her kids, helped both her son and her that time husband, who later became ex-husband, through some extraordinarily difficult health challenges, mental health and physical health challenges. And, you know, I really went the distance with this family. She ended up getting divorced, and she was a lawyer, a state attorney. She had Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. Basically, we had this agreement that when she felt she couldn't go on, she would reach out to me. And so I'm driving home from the desert after a clergy 3-day retreat, where frankly, I would have rather stuck needles in my eyes than been at a 3-day clergy retreat. But so I'm coming home, I'm in traffic, I'm tired, the phone rings. And it's her second husband calling me. He says, Rabbi, Tara needs to see you right away. Please come. And I said, you know, I'm driving home from the desert. I'm going to come right to you. I'll be there in an hour and 15 minutes. I walk in the door, and, you know, most people's lives at the end are reduced to the square footage of a hospital, rented hospital bed. And this was the case. You know, you walk in the house and you just know. First, you see the ramp at the front door. And then you walk in and you smell that antiseptic smell. You see the stack of adult diapers in the corner. You see the commode and all of that. And you realize this is the home of a severely compromised person. I go up to the bedroom, and Tara, a few days before, had completely lost her ability not only to speak, it was impossible to understand her. It was garbled. But she had lost the ability to point to letters on a chart. So frankly, I mean, she could not communicate other than blinking yes or no. So I went in, I held her hand. I said, Tara, I know why you've called me here. And why she called me there was we had this agreement. In California, we have a compassionate death law. that if you would die within 6 months anyways of a disease, and you can get two doctors to authorize it and a mental health professional, you can be prescribed end-of-life drugs that once you take them, you'll die within minutes. And she was asking me for permission to take the drugs. Without physically being able to speak, I said, I know why I'm here. Are you ready? And, you know, I got the blink, yes. And she was really, really struggling to breathe. She had a gape and a tortured looking face. And she could only grunt. I mean, this was really raw. So I said, Tara, I'm going to step out in the hallway for a minute with Paul and her daughter, whose real name I won't use. I'm going to step outside. And I stepped outside with them and I said, look, from the perspective of Jewish law, she shouldn't do it because Jewish law has no hierarchical value assigned to life. All lives are of perfectly equal value. Doesn't matter if you're a Down syndrome person or a handsome billionaire, a neurophysicist. It doesn't matter if you have 10 minutes or 10 decades ahead of you to live. All life is of equal value. There is no hierarchical value to life, number one. Number two, Jewish law allows passive euthanasia. In other words, you can remove impediments to death.
Like pulling the plug. You could do that.
Pulling the plug, stopping a medication, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But what you cannot do is active euthanasia. You can't just pump up the morphine to the point of death. It's not allowed. Why? Because that would be second guessing or creating a hierarchy of value in terms of human life.
And that comes from scripture? Is that?
Well, yes and no. So when now we get into something a little complex, but the path of Jewish law begins in scripture, begins in the Hebrew Bible, but it then moves into a period of history we call the rabbinic period, where over about 6 or 7 centuries, schools of great rabbis debated various aspects of life and law and kind of established the normative legal system that has governed Judaism for the past 2,000 years. Now, this idea of hastening death unnaturally, forcing God's hand, or say forcing nature's hand, is to imply this person's life is no longer of value. So it's forbidden. And I explained this to them. And then I said to them, but I do not understand why we would not treat a person with the same dignity and compassion with which we treat a dog. So it is contrary to Jewish law, but I am going to go in there and tell Tara, it's okay, take the pills. And that's what I did.
So Rabbi Leader and Steve Leader
diverged. And the way I say it in the book is about 2 hours later, my phone rings. I'm at home then. And it's Paul, her husband. And he says, Rabbi, Tara's gone. Thank you. Thank you so much. And as I put it in the book, he thought he was calling Rabbi Leader, but it was Steve Leader who picked up the phone. In other words, I made the conscious decision to privilege my humanity above even my role and my faith and my tradition. This is the truth of being on the inside of other people's lives. Like, sometimes the sages they're wrong. Just as in some ways the Bible, in my opinion, is wrong.
I think it's well documented. There's many places it's wrong.
Well, I'm not talking about it from a factual standpoint. That's pretty obvious, in fact. But I don't see the Bible as a book of facts. It's a book of truths. If you try to read the Bible as a book of facts, you're going to have a big, big challenge on your hands.
Okay? Get out a highlighter.
Yeah, because while there are some facts in it, it's not a book of facts. It's a book of myths. And myth does not mean lie. A myth is a way of describing a truth about the human experience, about the human condition, right? That's Bible. Now, it was certainly right in and of its day. But just as our Constitution has evolved, so too has Jewish law evolved, and so too does life evolve. And at times, I am comfortable saying, look, they were right in their day, certainly in their minds, but I don't believe homosexuals should be stoned to death. I don't believe rebellious children should be taken outside the city gates and thrown off a cliff.
I don't know. Do you have teenagers?
Yeah, well, I don't believe that polygamy is really the way to go. I don't believe in animal sacrifice, right? We evolve. But I think this is also a very important distinction, Paul, between fact and truth. I read the Bible for its truths. I do not read it for its facts because it's not a history book. Noah did not get all those animals on the boat, okay?
It's unlikely.
However, are we responsible for the destiny of the creatures on this planet and the planet itself? Yes, and that's the truth of the story.
But what if modern doctrine is pulled literally from the Bible?
Do you mean what about fundamentalists?
Basically, yeah, or parts of Catholicism, which is my family's tradition.
In my opinion, it is an incorrect understanding of the Bible's intention. The Bible is not a history book and not doctrinal, particularly. The Catholic critique of Judaism was always that it was a religion of deed, not creed. Because it's true, Judaism is essentially a series of prescribed behaviors, not beliefs. I don't think the rabbis cared at all whether you believed in God. What they cared about was that you behaved as if you believed. Mm. And so it is a very this worldly behavior oriented. We have these commandments we call mitzvot or mitzvah. These are prescribed behaviors, not beliefs. I can't convince you about the importance of the Sabbath, for example, and observing it by saying it's God's word and you must. That doesn't teach you anything. What I can do is say, Paul, try it for 4 weeks in a row and let's talk about it.
Yeah.
It's the experiential component. It's the living of it. It's almost like I cannot teach you how to swim with a textbook and a video. I could show you YouTube videos about swimming for decades. I could have you read textbooks about swimming. I could bring in Michael Phelps to talk to you about swimming. I could do this for decades, put you in the deep end and you will drown because I haven't taught you how to swim. I've taught you about swimming, not the same thing. So much of a spiritual or religious orientation is about doing it rather than talking about it. It's about getting in the water, not about reading about being in the water.
Shabbat, Sabbath, these things, these traditions have developed to foster community, to foster togetherness, to foster relationships. And then you look at the Harvard longitudinal studies that say, where does true human happiness come from? And it comes from relationships.
Yes.
That's not a coincidence.
Not at all. Not at all. There is a requirement that there are individual prayers, but very few. A prayer service, or for example, saying the mourner's prayer for a loved one who's died, must be done in the presence of at least 9 other people. You have to have a minimum quorum of 10 to engage in many Jewish activities.
I love that it's a quorum.
Yeah. Well, what does this do? What does this do? Think about it. Mm. First of all, it prevents you, the sufferer, from being alone. Secondly, it prevents Jews who are serious about their Judaism from living randomly in the middle of nowhere amongst none of their own. It forces community, right? You have to be close to others if you need them in order to fulfill your religious opportunities. And get this vis-a-vis the Sabbath. If you're a serious Sabbath observer, in an Orthodox sense, you don't drive on the Sabbath. So you also have to live within walking distance of a synagogue.
That's right. Yeah, right.
And that also creates community. So there is so much about being together. And it is an antidote to modernity. And it is an antidote. Look, we already talked about the prisoner cannot free himself. We're not better alone. We're better together.
I thought we were going to talk more about death today, and that's fine that we didn't get to as much as I wanted to.
Part two.
I'd love to continue this conversation. There's many times I'll do an interview and I'm like, is it 30 minutes yet? And now I'm dreading the end of this hour.
I'll come back.
I cannot talk to you today without asking you what Israel means to you.
Oh, God. Israel to me represents the one and only place in the world where being a Jew, being who I am, is normative and organic and connected to the most ancient aspects of my origins. In Israel, in Jerusalem, I lived there for a couple of years. You can walk where Abraham walked or was said to have walked. You can touch the retaining wall upon which the ancient temple stood. That's called the Wailing Wall or the Western Wall. It was a retaining wall, but that's all that's left. But it's very real. You can be in a place where the bus driver, the vet, the bagger at the grocery store, the barista. Where else in the world can you have this feeling of being among your own? And while being among your own, being exposed to such extraordinary diversity. You know, this idea of Israel as a colonizer and white privilege and all that, it's such bullshit. More than 50% of Jews living in Israel are people of color. They were forced out of Arab nations or they came on their own. But most Israelis are people of color. They are from places like Morocco, Ethiopia, Iran, Iraq, you know, Istanbul, you name it, Lebanon, Syria. They're dark. And that too is amazing that we're siblings. And we're so different and so alike. So Israel's just amazing in that sense and powerful. But it also represents the only real guarantee that Jews have against homelessness. And if you look historically at Jewish life, we've been kicked out of a lot of places. It's always been to the peril of those nations. It never goes well for them ultimately, but we have been kicked around the globe. I mean, the first exile was 587 BCE when the Babylonians destroyed the first temple and took us to Babylonia. Or Babylon. And that, you know, we're talking 26, 27 centuries ago, and we've been kicked around the globe, and Israel represents the one place where we know we have a home. You know, I don't remember who said it. Some writer said, home is the place where when you show up, they have to let you in.
Yeah.
That's Israel for all of us. And also, it's the place where Hebrew lives and breathes as a language. It's not just a language of sacred text. It's a living, breathing, evolving language. And I'm a word guy, and that too is very beautiful. Right now, what it means to me is it's a trigger for all of us who know something about Jewish history. There is no guarantee that Israel will continue to exist. There is no guarantee that Jews will continue to exist. The world has come close more than once in annihilating the Jewish people or disfiguring the Jewish people permanently. The Holocaust was a permanent disfigurement. It was the severing of limbs. And, you know, that's Israel. They live in that shadow. And there is this feeling in me, I can only speak for myself on this, you asked me what it means to me. There is this feeling in me that if Israel isn't safe, neither am I. Mm. Israel, like every other nation, makes mistakes, has problems. But that should never fundamentally threaten its right to exist.
When you see anti-Israel protests or comments from otherwise very intelligent people, what would you like to convey to them? What do you wish they understood?
What it is like to be a nation of approximately 7 million, which is about the size, smaller than LA County, a nation of about 7 million Jews, and it's about the size of New Jersey, and it is surrounded
much by nicer, much nicer than New Jersey.
Surrounded by 400 million Muslims, a small percentage of whom, but nevertheless a very large number of whom, are committed to your complete and total annihilation. I wish they understood what that's like. In Los Angeles, when I'm trying to explain it to people, I say, imagine 150,000 guided missiles on Mulholland Drive pointed at Studio City.
Right.
That's Gaza and southern Israel, by the way. That's the distance. 1 freaking mile. Hezbollah in the north has 150,000, not rockets, made out of drain pipe like in the south. We're talking about Iranian-provided laser-guided missiles capable of reaching all of Israel. What if you were an American living in Studio City and there were 150,000 guided missiles on Mulholland and people who hate and deny your right to exist have their finger on the button? What would you do? What would you want?
Anything I could.
Yeah, what would you ask of your government? And I would also say that it's very important to disambiguate Hamas from the larger Palestinian community and ethos. I am pro-Palestinian. I am anti-Hamas, and I am anti-Hezbollah. The Palestinians have been the doormat of the Middle East for 75 years at least. The doormat. They deserve better. They deserve better from their own leaders. They deserve better from their Arab brethren and Arab nations. The president of Egypt said, we will kill millions to protect our border. He wasn't talking about millions of Israelis. He was talking about citizens of Gaza. We will kill millions. Nobody wants them. Jordan doesn't. Syria doesn't. Egypt doesn't. No one. They deserve better from their Arab brethren, and they deserve better from Israel, and they deserve better from us. Now, here's the disambiguation. However, that very legitimate, deserving, complex, nuanced conversation and agenda has nothing to do with Hamas and October 7th. Nothing. Because Hamas's mission has nothing to do with the betterment of Palestinians. They want one thing and one thing only, dead Jews, not dead Israelis, dead Jews.
Anywhere in the world.
Everywhere in the world, not anywhere, everywhere. I want people to understand this, that we have a duty to humanity to oppose Hamas and Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad and the Islamic Brotherhood. And we have a duty to the Palestinians who are not filled with hatred to improve their lives. And the other thing I would say, you got me going now, we need a part two. The other thing I will say to you is, and this feels and sounds very harsh, we also have to disambiguate murder and killing. Hamas murdered and forced Israel to kill Now, they, of course, then can flip the script and pretend that the victimizer is the victim. That's the playbook.
Their playbook is working quite well.
It always has. It always has. They attack, Israel defends itself, and then they position themselves as the victims. And they use the body count to justify their victimhood. Now, again, I do understand how harsh and even heartless this sounds, but war is generally harsh and heartless. And certainly raping, murdering, gang raping, sodomizing, dismembering, burning, torturing, that is inhumane. So that's what we're responding to here. Okay, this was unprovoked. People said to me in the beginning, Rabbi, what about the commandment, thou shalt not murder? I said, well, there is no such commandment. I'm sorry, thou shalt not kill. I said, there is no such commandment. That's not the commandment. It's thou shalt not murder. Lo tirzach is the Hebrew. It's a different word in Hebrew, just like English. Murder and killing are not the same word, and they are not the same thing. We are not allowed to murder. We are allowed to kill murderers and to kill in self-defense. And yes, there will be collateral damage. Now, then we get to the body count metric. Yes, but 1,200 people, Israelis, were killed and 240 were kidnapped. And now there are 30,000 dead in Gaza and half of them are not terrorists, et cetera, et cetera. It's disproportionate. Okay, so what are the Israelis supposed to do? Are they to be proportionate? What are they supposed to do? Wait for a music festival in Gaza? Go to the music festival and rape and murder 1,200 people and kidnap 240, not 241. 200. Is that the proportionate response? Is that what you're hoping for? In World War II, about 500,000 French and 600,000 Brits died in World War II fighting the Nazis. Somewhere between 6.5 and 8.5 Germans die. Not all of them Nazis, by the way, but many of them. Does the fact that more than 10 times as many Germans died than Brits, does that make the Germans the victims? Does that make the Nazis the good guys? No. No. Body count is not the metric by which we determine good and evil, right and wrong, victim and victimizer. The United States dropped 2 atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. No warning, no leaflets, no text messages. Does that mean we, the United States, after Pearl Harbor, we were the victimizers? Really? When we're trying to end this war and ultimately save lives? So I'm not an apologist for Israel. Israel makes mistakes. By the way, it's perfectly fine to criticize Israel. You should read the Israeli papers. One newspaper in Israel. I have no problem with criticizing Israel. I do have a problem confusing victim and victimizer. I have a problem confusing good and evil. And I have a problem confusing who is to blame.
When you pray for the Middle East, what do you pray for?
For peace. Now, let's talk about peace. Peace does not mean the absence of conflict. Peace at its highest value is not the absence of conflict. The highest value, the highest order of magnitude of peace is an environment in which disagreements can be addressed civilly. That's peace. Peace is not the absence of conflict. It's an environment where conflict is resolved peacefully or even accepted as irreconcilable. So that's the peace I hope for, a peace in the Middle East and in Israel, not without disagreement, but without death and violence as an expression of that disagreement. And here's why I'm optimistic. we have multiple examples that prove that neighbors can coexist in peace in the Middle East. The peace treaty with Egypt has held. The peace treaty with Jordan has held. UAE, held. Sudan, held. Bahrain, held. You can make peace with Israel, and Israel can make peace with you. And hopefully soon that will happen with Saudi Arabia, which is why Hamas, Iran really via Hamas, broke the ceasefire on October 7th, because they don't want peace. Peace with Saudi Arabia, that is an extraordinarily profound move in the right direction.
Who could have imagined that 15 years ago?
Well, we had it with Egypt more than 15 years ago. And you know, the big question with the first peace treaty, which was Sadat and Begin, Israel and Egypt, was A, would it survive Sadat's death? And B, would it survive a major Israeli war with some other Arab nation? And the answer was yes and yes.
But you see the price Sadat paid for making peace with Israel.
Well, this is the problem, frankly, with Yasser Arafat. Ask Bill Clinton. We'll see if we can get him on your podcast.
Let's do it.
Bill Clinton will tell you, I had a deal
right, for
the Palestinians, 98% of the West Bank, total autonomy. And Yasser Arafat wouldn't do it. He blinked at the last minute. Did he blink because he was worried about being assassinated? Maybe. Did he blink because it was contrary to the identity he had formed for himself?
Or did he blink because they don't want peace?
Well, exactly. We don't know. But we know that it takes two to make a deal. And there was no one there to make what would have been a great deal. Now, I will also say this. Let's talk about this two-state solution. There has been a two-state solution in place since 2003, when the Israelis handed the keys to Gaza to the Palestinian people and completely walked away. There hasn't been a Jew living in Gaza since 2003, unless that Jew has been held hostage. The Palestinians were given Gaza as a state. They were given complete and total control and autonomy. They could have used all that foreign aid and help from Israel to turn Gaza into the Singapore of the Middle East. About the same size and about the same population, beautiful seacoast. There could have been beautiful resorts, solar farms, world-class universities and hospitals, and who knows what else. But Hamas didn't want Singapore. They want dead Jews. There has been a two-state solution in place. And I have to say, look, I believe the Palestinians deserve a state, but we gave them something very much akin to a state with their own autonomy. And what did we get in return? Did we get peace or rockets?
Well, let's hope your prayers for peace are answered.
I'm optimistic. I really am. Look, there will always be a component of people. Anti-Semitism is the oldest of stories. Jew hatred is the oldest of stories. But I do see very positive movement toward peace with reasonable parties in the Middle East, which hopefully will further marginalize the radicals. And further marginalized, they may be a little easier to manage.
Well, this has been a really interesting conversation. Your book was quite enjoyable. We'll talk about that the next time. The book that I just listened to, actually, in your wonderful voice, The Beauty of What Remains, is all about the way Steve dealt with the death of his father and also weaving in a lot of thoughts about the way Jews handle death and build community around death.
And others, right? How Hindus do it and the ancients did it and Christians do. I mean, it's a field guide, really, and a memoir.
So for anybody going through the death of a loved one, grief of your own, or your own impending death, I highly recommend looking through Steve's work. Is at steveleader.com. Do I have that right, Steve?
You do, but the only social media I really engage with is Instagram, and that's at steve_leader.
L-E-D-E-R, yeah. Hey, thanks so much for your time. Best of luck with everything in your congregation. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great weekend, Paul.
Well, we covered a lot of stuff in this conversation, so I guess the first thing I'll say in our takeaways is thank you to Rabbi Leader for showing up and showing up with your full presence, attention, and honesty in this conversation. No wonder you've been doing what you've been doing for almost four decades. You inspire confidence and you make a person feel heard and seen. So thank you. We'll get to the current events last, but let's start with some of the things we covered much earlier in the conversation. When talking to somebody who's made grave mistakes, what does he do? He helps orient them to the future by saying, I don't know about you, but I've given up hope for a better past. What a wonderful way to help someone orient themselves toward the future. As he mentioned in his anecdote from the Hebrew scripture about Lot's wife looking back on Sodom and Gomorrah, if we live our lives focused on the misery of the past, we become bitter and paralyzed like a pillar of salt. All we have is today and the future. Orient yourself in that direction and move forward. I thought his comments about fundraising, having spent 3 years as a professional fundraiser after college at my alma mater, Rhodes College, was really interesting. If you want money, ask for advice. If you want advice, ask for money. Anybody that's ever been in a position to, even if you're just on the annual fund parents committee at your kid's school, anybody who's ever called up a friend or a peer and said, hey, will you donate money to the parents fund? You'll get an earful. You might also say, if you want excuses, ask for money. But I just thought that was a very interesting insight born of experience from somebody who's one of his main job responsibilities is to ask for money. So keep that in mind as you move forward. Probably relevant in a lot of other areas of our lives as well. Next takeaway, and you read a lot about this in his book, death doesn't change us. If a person lives in denial, they will die in denial. It was really interesting to hear him talk about death and these deathbed experiences and how consistent they were in the thousands of times he's counseled one of his, they're congregation members on their deathbed. Really, really interesting insight. I thought his explanation of the Bible being a book of truth as opposed to a book of fact, I found that to be very comforting because I think that if we try to interpret, if we hold the Bible to the standard of absolute truth, it will be riddled full of holes because it isn't true in many, many places, including in the place where the Gospels accuse the Jews of killing Jesus, as I've written about on my Substack, to which you should subscribe, by the way. It is just a tragic, tragic thing that has led to thousands of years of persecution of the Jews. The Bible, the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, I think could accurately be described as a book striving for truth as opposed to a book that is relaying facts. And if we can view it with those broad strokes, maybe we can embrace what we all have in common instead of clinging to every single word as being the inerrant word of an almighty. Speaking of which, the conflict in Gaza, I'm grateful to Rabbi Leder for speaking in an unfiltered and honest way about the war in Gaza. I haven't spoken to him a lot about it in the past, but I am very pro-Israel. I believe that their country was violated. I believe that there are many, many millions of people in their surrounding countries that want to see Israel wiped off the map. And if you equivocate on this issue, you are not admitting that, or you are agreeing with the fact that Israel does not deserve to exist. So ask yourself that. And if you were an Israeli, what would you do in response to Gaza's horrific attacks? It doesn't mean it's not morally complicated, but it does mean that if Israel has a right to exist, it has a right to defend itself. And if it doesn't have a right to exist, well, that's a whole other conversation. And you might want to ask yourself, well, if the Jews aren't going to live in Israel, where are they going to live? And the answer to that question is not pretty. That's all we got for today. We'll be back next week. Until then, Mike Carano, make me sound smart.